You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. Our show is about to begin.
And now, here's part two of our interview with Mike Mattesino. This is The Soundtrack Show.
I wanted to ask you about something that listeners write in and ask me about all the time that I am not qualified to answer, and that is about what you're touching on here, the basic economics of soundtrack releases over the years. You know, digital aside and, you know, our economy aside, you know, in terms of soundtrack sales since the 90s, you know, obviously it just like fell off a cliff. But are we seeing a comeback of sorts with sites like La La Land Records or Entrada and all of these incredible, you know, special edition releases? It just seems like it's such a great time, just even in the past 10 years, to be a collector of this stuff. Like, we're seeing more music, more options, more CDs, more vinyl sales. Is there a comeback happening of sorts?
I don't know that there is, honestly. I feel like when I first came to LA from New York in the early 90s, there was an embracing of catalog and of film history, not only within the industry itself, meaning the home entertainment departments within the studios and in what historians were doing and programs that were going, but I think with just the general public. I was seeing, you know, that was when we started getting, when American Movie Classics, the cable channel, was completely different. It actually showed American Movie Classics. and, you know, Turner Classic Movies came on the scene and, you know, but on home video, you got movies from all eras were freely released on VHS, on Laserdisc, which I was involved in. And it was a viable thing. You had people in their 20s willing to watch movies from the 30s, 40s, 50s. What's gone by the wayside, I think, is this interest in the past. And it's tough to get people interested in catalog. Even, I think, among soundtrack collectors, there are people who really like what we call the golden age scores. But they're sort of a dying breed. You're not getting... you know, it hasn't renewed itself. You get a lot of people who are passionate and have a fondness for the 80s and 90s. But it's very, very hard to get the deep catalog golden age stuff, you know, to be embraced by people. And it's sad because the older it is, obviously, the more work it takes to put them together. And I love working on those things because, again, it's part of this cultural heritage, as I said. Mm. So I think that we've kind of lost that. When we did the RCA Victor Star Wars, physical stores, brick and mortar store sales on day one of Star Wars Episode 4 were 25,000 copies. I don't even know that you could even do 25,000 copies even of that score now. So, I mean, I ended up getting a gold record plaque for it because it sold over 250,000. You know, it's such a specialized market. There was a time where Film Score Monthly, they could do between 5,000 and 10,000 copies. It would eventually sell. Now it's really hard for anything to do more than 1,000. But I think that the resurgence that I'm seeing is not in that area, but it's with film music being performed.
Right.
With live to the picture concerts and so forth. We have more film music being done in concert halls by symphony orchestras than ever before. For me, I'm asking myself, how do we translate that to interest in buying the music and owning the music? Well, there again, the answer is that people want it digitally. That's how the general public consumes music now. So, you know, and there's all kinds of boring stuff I could tell you about our attempts to get CDs into some of the symphony shops and things like that. And it's very hard from a business standpoint. The model doesn't work.
Interesting.
You know, we're still trying to figure it out. But I speak to people like David Newman about this. You know, what can we do? It's like you're having so much of this music performed. It's like if these people only mm-hmm. knew that they could go to the concert and then get the score, we might be able to rebuild this market a little bit. So it's very hard. I actually see it dwindling. I just think that you know, everybody who is passionate about it has to reach out. They can't just, you know, be in their own little world with it. You have to go out and share it. You have to tell people about it. You have to bring people over and play them some music. You know, do what you can to get interest. I mean, all of it has validity. All of it is a window into history. All of our history is preserved on film and on audio tape, you know, and it's important. I don't really see this as a renaissance. I think the quality has improved. The attention to the detail and the comprehensiveness of the releases, that's improved. We've learned more about how to do these things, but it has not directly translated into an increase of the market. I would love to see it even get up to something like 10 or 20,000 for a well-known title. I think the labels would all rejoice on that. They would stay in business for quite a long time, even if we could just double what we're doing now.
Interesting. That's really interesting. You know, I always say, and I always say to people, you know, if I'm at conventions and things, and I do a lot of Star Wars conventions, and a lot of folks buy the 3¾-inch plastic figures and things. And I always want to encourage people, if you love, say, Star Wars, or you love Superman, or you love Back to the Future, buy the soundtrack, buy the Blu-ray, buy a piece of the thing that you love, and support the music. Because what ends up happening on the back end is I will get emails saying, why don't we have special editions of the following movies? You know, and I always say it's because, well, because nobody buys them. You know, we want them. You mentioned David Newman. I went to, of course, we make our pilgrimage to see John Williams at the Hollywood Bowl every year. And of course, David Newman is conducting this wonderful first opening half and you know, talks about all of these incredible film scores. And before John Williams takes the stage to play The Force Awakens or Superman, you've got David Newman playing Korngold and The Adventures of Robin Hood, and you've got thousands of people listening. And I have that same instinct of how do we generate that same interest? Because, you know, live concerts. I remember when John Williams did E.T. in 2002, you know, and performed it live, and that was such a new thing. Now it happens in orchestras all over the country, all over the world. So it is kind of this weird. You sense. I mean, yeah, you just spelled it out completely. There's this weird kind of duality of it's more popular than ever, yet sales of soundtracks are still lower than ever. And how do we fix that?
Well, you've given me a lot just there. For, first of all, Next year, let's definitely connect when you're down for the Bowl concert. But I have to also say that, you know, when I first came, I think to California, John Williams doing the concert at the Bowl was the first time I went there. And I might have missed a couple years, but generally speaking, I've gone every year. And it's always wonderful. There were years where he did entire evenings of his own music, which is just mind-boggling, because I think maybe in terms of a composer who could conduct an entire concert only of his own music and it would all be recognized, I don't know that we have had too many of those. Maybe John Philip Sousa.
Right.
But, you know, so that was tremendous. And I've just looked for, that's just like the summer capper. Down here. We look forward to that Labor Day weekend. It's like the end of summer ritual. But I have to tell you, the ones of the recent years where David's done the first half, I think they're even better. Because, you know, David, as you said, comes out and gives, you know, all these kids are there who have come to hear Star Wars and wave their lightsabers around. But they're getting this sort of little primer in film music history. And when David will conduct some of his father's music, that just, again, that there blows my mind. You know, what must it be like to stand there with the Los Angeles Philharmonic and 16,000 people there, you know, and you're conducting something your dad wrote, you know, 60 years ago. And he talks about John and we're playing in John's as a violinist in John's recordings. And then John comes out and then he talks about the Newmans and the role that that family played in his career. Yeah. So it's just, you get this like all of Hollywood history just sort of just happening right there on the stage, you know, in one evening. And I just think that those are great. And then it leads up to, you know, him doing the Star Wars selections and all the lightsabers come out. And it just becomes this magical experience. You know, so I think that they're, you know, it's gotten even better. But again, I wonder, you know, if you could let all those people know that this music exists and they can enjoy it, could we increase this market? I'd really like to.
Yeah,
really like
because the more people that buy it, the more music we end up getting, you know, and it uplifts everyone. And that's really what this show is about, too. It's really about uplifting the work of other people and trying to give a platform to people like you and anyone else to talk about this stuff and how just fantastic this music is.
And now for a brief intermission.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We return now to the Soundtrack Show.
You know, we were talking about David Newman and some scores in film score history that maybe don't necessarily get as much attention as something that's as big as Star Wars. Are there, of the dozens, if not hundreds of scores, actually it is hundreds of scores that you've released, are there some that you just think are so spectacular that never get the recognition that you feel like they deserve, that if you had an opportunity to speak to as many, you know, listeners like of this show to say, hey, if you haven't checked out this score that I did, this is some incredible music that you really need to go out and discover. Are there any gems like that that come to mind that you've worked on over the years?
Oh, gosh.
Not to put you on the spot or anything.
No, maybe. Well, if we keep this, centered on John Williams for the moment,
sure.
There's an obvious one, which is that he's known for Star Wars, but wow, the same year was Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And to me, that's my favorite score of his, and the one that he is in the favorite of his own. And probably he would have been happier to get the Oscar for that rather than Star Wars. Not that he's not proud of Star Wars and his connection with it, because, you know, he's it's very, very important to him. But I was in New York for the premiere of the Star Wars in Concert at Lincoln Center with David conducting, and in my room at the Princeton Club working that afternoon on the liner notes for Close Encounters. Actually, not the performance. I had to go out then to rehearsal, but I was working on the liner notes to Close Encounters and trying to make sure I was getting that right and listening to that music. Then I went to the rehearsal for Star Wars, and I enjoyed it, but I couldn't help feeling that, well, you know, this is good, but Close Encounters really is just something. It takes the role of score in a movie into another level, where, you know, Star Wars is very sort of does what film scoring has always done. It's the emotional heart of the film and helps propel the plot along, et cetera, et cetera. I did feel that on a couple of moments where David had them turn the movie off, where he wanted to work on something, that I would rather have had them just sit there and play all 88 minutes of Star Wars without the picture, and I'll just sit here and listen, you know, rather than have to compete with the dialogue and sound effects. But that's a case where I think you get the emphasis on the five-note signal from Close Encounters, but there's just such ambition and with that score and such. I don't know if we prior to that, if we had a real mainstream movie that really had such a challenging musical approach. Very, very daring. I think it really paved the way for what you could get a little bit atonal and a little bit experimental in film scores. I don't know that they were really doing that at the symphonic level until after that. You had jazz composers, Don Ellis and Quincy Jones doing stuff in the 70s that was, you know, in jazz influenced and not necessarily melodic. Those would come along. But in terms of the full symphony, you know, what Kubrick did in 2001, A Space Odyssey, with existing music, John Williams then did in Close Encounters with original music. And I think that just, it opened up so much. I think it was as influential on film scoring just as much as Star Wars. And then the other personal favorite of mine is Empire of the Sun, which I just, I loved working on that thing. It was kind of hard, but I loved finally having all the music from that and really exploring that and discovering that what a challenge that was, because the music had to be emerging from the character's imagination rather than the plot itself. So terribly difficult challenge to find just the right music for that film, because I don't think that really, there had been a time where that really was called for. It was just a unique situation where, and that's at least my interpretation of the score, is that it's emanating from the character's imagination and creating in his mind how the world works. That's something I would just recommend, just on the subject of John Williams. Get away from Star Wars and start checking out some other things. 1941 is actually in my top 10 John Williams scores list. I just think that's absolutely fabulous. It's not a bad or boring note anywhere in it. It's just absolute crackers from beginning to end.
That was another great release, the 1941 release. And hearing all of that music.
I mean, again, there, the album was fine. Mm-hmm. But that if he wrote that score in, say, 1999 rather than 1979, we wouldn't have just gotten a 35-minute album. Mm-hmm. So, and especially not with that much, terrific music composed and recorded for it. It makes the original album feel kind of like a sampler. Still valid, still mm-hmm. worthy as kind of the assembly of the time and what they did. And there was a case where I reconstructed the original album for disc two so that we had a reason to include all the alternates and source music and things like that as bonuses. But when you hear the whole, 70-something mm-hmm. minutes of actual score done for the film, it's just amazing. It's just, here he is right at the peak of his powers and, for a not very successful film, but there are no warts on that score at all. It's just, it's an amazing piece of work to me.
The Soundtrack Show will continue in a moment. We return now to the Soundtrack Show.
You are still working with the John Williams camp and, of course, with Amblin. Right now, you're still working with him. In fact, I understand you have another really exciting release that we're about to get. Do you want to talk about that?
You're referring to Schindler's List.
I am. I am referring to Schindler's List. I'm very excited.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So, so it's the 25th anniversary mm-hmm. of that film. It's getting a 1,000-screen reissue in the U.S. theatrically. Starts December 7th. And the suggestion came up of doing a soundtrack release on it. Earlier this year, we, with La La Land, did Saving Private Ryan mm-hmm. for its 20th anniversary. But there was a case where it was, in terms of the ratio of score to the running time of the film, had less music,
right,
frame to frame or beat by beat, than most scores John's done for Stevens films. And so consequently, only a few things were left off of the original album. But, we did get asked about it over the years, would there have been an opportunity to get the film versions of some of those cues out? And so so we did it this year. Has a couple of bonus tracks on it with the remaining unreleased music from Saving Private Ryan. Schindler's List was unique in that the approach you know, was a difficult one because there's a sacrosanct quality about it, and ultimately the decision was, this is an album we really don't want to touch. Mm-hmm. We want to leave it as it was, and you know, just make sure that it sounds good. So for that, we went to the Glenn Meadows master that was done for the gold CD, and we got that original digital deliverable back for that, and that became disc one. Mm-hmm. There is a degree of unreleased music that wasn't included on the album, but also a lot of source music, and it ultimately, you know, we listened to all of it. The source music just seemed kind of impertinent. It serves a function within the story, but even if it is music that John arranged or conducted, it felt impertinent. So what we ultimately did was come up with a 28-minute program of unreleased cues and alternates and a couple of film versions. That's basically a revisitation of the score on the occasion of its 25th anniversary. And, so having gone through it, it's, again, that the focus is on material that was not on the album or material that's in the film that was not on the album. To put together just sort of a reflective experience on the occasion of the 25th anniversary, and an opportunity to write some nice liner notes and get it back into circulation and help be part of this whole anniversary reissue, because it's interesting that the movie is 25 years old, which is half the length of time as the length of time between the events in the story and the time when the film is released. So if you say 1943 to 1993, that's 50 years. So we've already gone half that time again. So the memories of the Holocaust and eyewitness accounts, you know, those people are basically gone. So yet the issues in the story and this kind of, hatred that we have in the world is still there, and still needs to be talked about. So, I think just in discussing what we were going to do for this album, that's basically what the decision was, to let's just come up with music that can be sort of an added experience to the album of a revisitation of the score on the occasion of the anniversary, and have it be sort of reflective and let each listener just experience it and just reflect on it. And and hopefully, in some small way, just spread some good into the world rather than hatred, because we have far too much of it.
And that music is just such an important and passionate voice in that movie. I mean, it's another one of those just transformative scores, and just took the movie to this whole different level of emotion. And I couldn't. It's absolutely inseparable. Unlike Private Ryan, which so much of it is just the harsh, cold reality of and lack of film score, I would argue that Schindler's List is just the opposite. The music is such the emotional engine of that film. I cannot wait to hear that release and hear the bonus material as well. And just kind of hear it all presented and kind of re-experience and rediscover that score. It's been a lot, many, many years, and great performances, great writing, just a great soundtrack. So thank you so much in advance for your work on that. That is definitely a pre-order for me, and I'm sure a lot of listeners. One thing that you've touched on a couple of times, and I just kind of wanted to wrap up this interview, and thank you again, by the way, for coming on the show, but your liner notes are such an incredibly important source of information for soundtrack collectors. And certainly for me, when I researched this show, I feel like the liner notes are such a huge part of your career and legacy, because oftentimes outside of your liner notes, very little to sometimes no information exists about some of these film scores, or at least more than just surface information. Can you talk about your process in researching and putting together these liner notes? How long does it take? And what is it that is most important to you that you try and convey when you're putting these liner notes into a release?
Well, I think that it's a little weird. I'm the only mastering engineer who also writes liner notes, so it's a bit strange. And there are some people who do just this. They just write. And so, but therefore, I tend to just pick and choose so that I don't get burned out on it. And it ends up being sort of a comfortable, at the end of the day, feels comfortable shift. But it is actually a gear shift. I mean, I can be working on, I tend to work on music and then find sort of a place where I can stop and just go into, just turn one side of the brain off, turn the other side on, and do the writing process. There's, of course, some crossover. But I generally find that once I get lost in the writing, I stick with it till it's done. And I will say that, a resource that we've in this community been very, very fortunate to have all these years is Ned Comstock at the Cinema Arts Library at USC. I would frequently go down there and he'd pull out things from the special collections for research, and has always been such a tremendous supporter of all these soundtracks. And on a lot of these releases with the detailed liner notes, it eventually reached a point where he told me that when students would come in and wanted research a certain film, that he would point them to the soundtrack releases, and particularly a lot of the ones that Film Score Monthly was doing. Which some of these films are very obscure, might have an A-list composer, but the film might be very obscure, so the soundtrack, oddly enough, becomes the one spot where it's kind of all of the research of the production of the movie, how it came to be, how and where it was filmed, and then is collected and put in one spot, and then you start talking about the music. So it becomes a place where you now don't have to go and read, a dozen different articles and notices here and there. It's like now all in one place, and you get that. So I had that in mind. That kind of told me that this had an importance to it. And so I try to think of it as, I want it to be worthy of something that could be in a research library, so that if you do get this very strange antiquated thing called physical media, and there's this actual paper booklet in it, it's going to tell you something. It's going to give you a glimpse into a certain time and place and a certain project and give you the right context, and have value in that way. My process basically is just the usual. I'll just go to the Academy Library, and just do the research. I end up with usually a document full of random notes, and with absolutely no clue how I'm ever going to shape it into something that makes any sense. Then the usual things, just internet research and listening to the music and making my own notes and just working at it like just a big ball of clay and just shaping it and cutting stuff and just working it until I kind of feel that it's right. And then each one's different. I, for example, felt that on Jurassic Park collection that it needed the – production, the information about the production of the films. Because I think I felt unless it had the context of how dinosaurs were depicted in cinema prior to that, and unless you understood what the revolution was to get the effects to the point where they were in Jurassic Park, then the music's not going to make any sense.
It's so true.
Because there's no way that you would write a theme like John wrote for Jurassic Park if it was, you know, just iguanas shot in slow motion, you know, in 1950. it wouldn't work. It's like you needed the context of what it took to make the film and what the gamble was that they were taking, along with things that I know you've commented about, which is this, in response to what I wrote there, which is about how there's sort of a parallel going on between our experience as an audience and the characters within the story. There's a sort of a self-awareness aspect of it. And so unless you understood that, the music you won't understand what the music's really accomplishing. So I felt that was necessary. As opposed to something like E.T., where I didn't feel that I wanted to explain the production, because it's, number one, it's been, there's other places to go for it. Jaws as well. Felt there's, you know, there's so many places to go to read and watch about the making of the films. So much behind the scenes footage has been shown, particularly with E.T., where the sort of the veil was pulled back. And I just felt that, you know, I want to put the veil back over, and I want to, you know, get the magic back, even to the point where I didn't even mention the actors' names in the liner notes, because I wanted it to be about the characters as if they're real people. So each one is a different approach. It usually tells me what it wants to be. And I think that any writer will kind of say that, or a composer working on a film score. The film dictates what the music's going to be. So there's an aspect of it that, you know, I feel like the typist, and that what it really is something that's circling around over my head in the air somewhere. And I'm just kind of channeling it and just, it tells me what the notes should be. Lately though, I have shied away from doing track by track. I don't like writing them. I don't like reading them. There are certain scores where it's appropriate. E.T. was one of them, Star Trek the Motion Picture. But I'm really starting to feel more of the mind now of, again, setting the context, maybe coming up with a few things to draw your attention to, but then backing off and let the listener live with the music and have his or her own experience and see what comes to mind. So, you know, that's kind of where I am now. And that just sort of feels right to me. I think, again, the Film Score Monthly era, that kind of established itself. It was part of its raison d'etre, you know, to be sort of archival. And that definitely has its place. But now I kind of feel like that can just sort of devolve into something where you're just being told what the scene is, and then what the music's doing. And I just feel like I don't want that. To me, it's a very cumbersome thing to read, and is just takes away from the pure musical experience of just, you know, give me a few little clothespins on the line and then let me listen to the score and see where my mind goes and what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Let me explore it myself as a listener. So it's a tightrope walk. You have to say just enough to, you know, give people a foundation for the experience, but not spoon feed them interpretations. I've really backed away from that aspect of things.
Boy, you've given me so much there to think about. And one of the first things that comes to mind, of course, is that, you know, we're talking about music that is written for a visual medium. You know, in the same way that it's impossible to talk about an opera without talking about characters and plot and the libretto, it's impossible to talk about film music without talking about story and character and motivation, and just like what you're doing, reacting to you know, what the music is telling you to write in your liner notes, the composer is doing with what the director's putting up on screen and reacting to that and trying to enhance that. And it, I guess it just is something that comes from someone like you who listens closely for a living, and it just is so reflected in your wonderful liner notes. And I really am torn by what you say, because I understand wanting to have a pure musical listening experience. And certainly in many cases, I think of a lot of concert pieces that people like John Williams have recorded specifically for soundtracks. That is wonderful. And in other cases, like you mentioned Jurassic Park, I can't tell you how brilliant I thought your writing was in terms of establishing that parallel between what the production was doing at the time by discovering digital dinosaurs and what the characters were going through. And that produced this kind of hymn, this church of nature and of science that ended up being that theme. And I think that what was so insightful about that, and I'm sorry to go on a tangent here, is that it not only helps you understand Jurassic Park, but it helps you understand The Lost World and why that has a much more traditional monster movie, sort of almost Max Steiner, to quote Spielberg, inspired score. I think your liner notes are, I'm just as big of a fan of your liner notes as I am your mastering work and your sequencing, because I do think that, you know, in many cases, this stuff is important to talk about. And I just greatly admire, and I want to wrap this up by saying, I greatly admire the amount of thought and time you put into all of this. You know, and some of my favorite soundtrack releases over the past 20 years have your fingerprints all over them. And I wouldn't have it any other way, especially when it comes to the liner notes, because it has enhanced my listening experience. And I can honestly say this podcast, my previous podcast, would not exist without being inspired by a lot of your writing and work. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I have to say, the only reason, if that's true about the writing, it's only because I pick and choose and don't get myself burned out on it. So, you know, I will, you know, I'll know about, you know, the ones that I want to write about. And, I'm very glad that I've gotten to do certain ones. My three favorite Goldsmith scores, Alien, Poltergeist, and Star Trek. And then my four, top Spielberg films, Jaws, Close Encounters, E.T. and Empire of the Sun. So, notches in the belt that I'm very, very proud of.
That's fantastic. Well, I can't wait to, I did pick up the Alien Special Edition. I can't wait to talk about it. There's so much there to discuss. Talking about behind the scenes and all of the drama there, but I really enjoyed reading all of that. You know, made a lot of sense out of a lot of things that I've seen and read in terms of documentaries. And this is what I mean. It's really great. And certainly I know you couldn't write liner notes for two soundtracks a week. So I'm glad that you're picking your battles so wisely, because we definitely are benefiting from it. So thank you, Mike Matesino. Thank you very much for stopping by the show. I hope to have you on sometime soon again.
Oh, let's do it again, David. Thank you.
All right, thank you.